Freedom of speech has always been a highly contested and complex topic. But when was the last time you considered your freedom to think? In this show, we look at how our online environment, riddled with fake news and geopolitical propaganda, is undermining our ability to think for ourselves and to hold our own opinions.
Hey folks, welcome to the Evolving Leader Podcast, the show born from the belief that we need deeper and more committed leadership to confront the world's biggest challenges. I'm Scott Allender.
And I'm John Gomes.
How are you feeling today, John?
To be honest, I am tired. It's been a long week and there has been a lot going on, both personally and professionally. So I'm really looking forward to the weekend. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling like I wish you were feeling energized because I too am quite tired. I am at the end of sort of 8 or 9 days of COVID, it finally caught me after 3 years. So doing pretty well, but a little fatigued and also just feeling a little bit disappointed by some of the most recent legislation and proposed legislation in the South and some of the things that are going on around here, which just leave me feeling quite sad. But I have a mix of feeling very hopeful, largely due to reading our guest work today. Today, we're joined by Susie Allegre. Susie is a specialist in international human rights and public international law. She's worked on an extensive range of human rights issues in the European Union and UN systems. She was an ombudsman at the Financial Ombudsman Service, deciding cases on discrimination and vulnerable consumers that provoked changes in the financial services industry. And internationally, her roles have included working as the attaché on accountability and governance for the EU in Uganda, coordinating donor responses to corruption in the country, and anti-terrorism advisor to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. She is currently the associate at Doughtry Street Chambers and a senior fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation. And she came to our attention with the recent publication of her amazing book, Freedom to Think. Susie, welcome to The Evolving Leader.
Thanks so much for having me. A real pleasure to speak to you. And I have to say, I'm feeling tired too.
Oh no.
Well, Susie, I was going to ask you that. So welcome to the show. I was going to ask you how you're feeling.
Well, it's mixed. I think it's been, it's been a long couple of months. But I am also feeling optimistic because I am this weekend back in the Spanish Basque Country, where I realize I first came to 30 years ago now. So it's very nice to be back somewhere familiar after the pandemic.
Mm. Well, you are a pioneer in the debate of digital human rights, particularly looking at the impact of artificial intelligence on freedom of thought and opinion. But before we dive into what all that means, can you give us a sense of the journey you've been on with your career and what's led you to that current focus?
Yeah, my career actually started right where I am now, in the Basque Country, where I came 30 years ago to learn Spanish with a plan to be a linguist, float around, maybe write some poetry. That was my dream back in the early 90s. And I landed up getting work translating and then as a research assistant in a conflict resolution NGO called Guernica Gogoratos here, which is about remembering Guernica. And that work was really my first encounter with human rights lawyers and human rights law as a way of dealing with conflict. And I just found it absolutely fascinating. It had never occurred to me that the law could be interesting. But after that experience, I mean, that's what pushed me back to qualify as a barrister in the UK. And after some time practicing as a criminal barrister in the UK, I then carried on my international career and I suppose took what I'd learned here from the Basque Country to work for international organizations like Amnesty International, and then for intergovernmental organizations like the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, looking at human rights in the context of counterterrorism, and then bigger picture questions sort of globally with the UN, and also, as you mentioned, tackling anti-corruption in East Africa with the European Union. And so it was really, I suppose, a drive to understand how the world works and to try to find ways to make things better, to promote peace, to promote prosperity, and to promote human rights. And that's been very much a guiding factor through my career.
In Freedom to Think, you argue that the online environment that we now have undermines our independence of opinion, and that the powerful use of it to strengthen the peripheral goal of those in power, influencing how we think and live our lives. And you illustrate this by starting with a brief history of legal freedoms to both holding beliefs and their expressions. Can we start there to help our listeners gain some perspective on today's issues?
Yeah, the right to freedom of thought is, in a sense, an incredibly old idea, but also something that has been relatively neglected. And the right to freedom of thought connects very clearly with the right to freedom of expression, or freedom of speech, as it's often called. And what we hear today is often discussions about freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and privacy, potentially including mental privacy. But we rarely hear about this idea of freedom of thought as it pertains to what goes on inside our heads. So not what I'm saying to you, but what I'm thinking, which is not necessarily the same thing as what I'm saying. Right to freedom of thought, you know, evolved through philosophy, particularly through the Enlightenment. And we see people like J.S. Mill talking about on liberty. And people like Voltaire as well, discovering how freedom of speech is all very well, but it might well land you up in jail, particularly if you lived in France in the 18th century. But freedom of thought is quite different. So as I say, this idea that we have a natural right to be able to think freely inside our heads. And what we see when that right became a legal right, firstly in the Universal Declaration on Human Rights in 1948, was that there was a difference between the way the right is protected inside our heads, so what's going on in our inner lives, and the way the right is protected in terms of expressing your opinions. And so while the right to express your opinions, to share your opinions, can be limited, for example, to protect the rights of others, the right to think whatever you like, however vile it may be, is absolute inside your head. So there can never be a justification for interfering or violating that freedom inside your head. Of course, we all engage with each other every day and we influence each other. But what the right to freedom of thought guarantees is the right not to have to reveal your thoughts. So never to be coerced to reveal what you're thinking or what your opinions are. And if you think about that, you know, in terms of, for example, the Spanish Inquisition, torturing people to admit to heresy, if you like. That is the kind of idea of coercion or trying to drag somebody's thoughts or opinions out of them. The second part of the right to freedom of thought inside your head is the right not to be manipulated. And again, we all influence each other in our daily interactions. That's part of what it means to be human. That is not a violation or an interference with your right to freedom of thought. The question is, when does influence tip over into manipulation? It's not something that's very clearly defined yet in law, but there's a very key concept there, the difference between influence and manipulation. And the third part of the right to freedom of thought is the right not to be penalized for your thoughts alone. So you may be penalized for what you say or what you do, but you can't be penalized simply for what is happening inside your head, what your beliefs are, or for inferences just about your beliefs. So when people are assuming they know what you're thinking, which is something that we find now, you know, looking at the AI world and sentiment analysis, that increasingly people claim to be understanding or knowing what we're thinking and how we're feeling. So that right to freedom of thought is based on those three kind of fundamental ideas. But again, it's different from freedom of speech because it's not about what we're saying and doing on the outside. It's about what's going on the inside. But ultimately, what's going on the inside is intimately connected with freedom of speech and freedom of information and our ability to interact with each other freely.
I'd like to hone in a little bit on this manipulation because it's no secret we're in a world where the power to spread fake news is incredible and it happens incredibly quickly. it's hard to keep up with what's happening in terms of the speed and the sort of all the different platforms which, you know, are spreading all these sort of ideas. How do we balance the sort of, I don't want to call it a right to do this, but the fact that this is happening with the rights to have the freedom to form our own thoughts? And there must be a lot of legal considerations and things, but can you pull that idea apart for us a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that's where you land up with the very big difference with freedom of thought to freedom of speech. So with freedom of speech and privacy, you're talking about often a balancing exercise. So where are the limitations? You know, in what circumstances can you limit someone's right to private life, for example, to protect public health or something like that? The same goes for freedom of speech. But when we're talking about freedom of thought or opinion, we're not talking about a balancing exercise anymore. Essentially, when you're talking about freedom of opinion, what you need to think about is where is that manipulative line? And wherever that line is, you can't cross it. One of the examples that I looked at from history was the concept of subliminal advertising. And so the idea of subliminal advertising was that you could avoid the annoyance of having to sit through an advert for your favorite fizzy drink at the cinema by simply flashing up messages so quickly that while your brain was aware of them, you were not consciously watching those images. So it was a way of bypassing your conscious faculties, but to still sell you stuff while you're in the cinema. So subliminal advertising, as I say, was sort of designed as this, isn't this fantastic? We can have advertising without the annoyance, and everybody wins. You know, the advertisers win, the consumers win, because they still go and buy the brand without actually having to have their movie disrupted. But clearly, legislators, particularly in Europe, saw how potentially dangerous this was. I mean, possibly also scarred in the aftermath of World War II and understanding the power of propaganda and the dangers of propaganda. And immediately banned subliminal advertising in Europe. And so subliminal advertising has been unlawful in Europe since it was first posited, really. It's still debatable whether it actually works. You know, a lot of people say it's pure snake oil, it's total rubbish, it doesn't work. But regardless of whether it works or not, it was clearly such a dangerous idea that it was worth governments and international organizations putting a ring fence around it and saying, actually, you can never do this because it's just too dangerous. And so it's not a balancing exercise. It's a, no, you can't do that. In the online environment that we live in at the moment, somehow it slipped through the net. I think it's something that kind of crept up so quickly that governments didn't really notice that this was what was happening. Because I think when you're talking about micro-targeted advertising and the kind of thing we saw with the Cambridge Analytica, you know, that is not really far off subliminal advertising. The same principles really apply. And it seems that it sort of developed incrementally without anybody really noticing. But I would say that that kind of micro-targeting, particularly when it's in real time, so that it's feeding off people's personal and individual emotional states, psychological vulnerabilities, has that same power of manipulation as we see with subliminal advertising. And we see it as well with dark patterns and with what's been called the attention economy. You know, the idea that things are being designed particularly to keep us hooked in order to affect how we're thinking and feeling without us making conscious decisions about what we're looking at or how long we're staring at our screens. So I think those ideas really raise that question of manipulation, and it goes down to basic principles of not even asking whether they work. It's what are they designed for? And if they are designed for manipulation, then probably we should be regulating against them.
This concept of manipulation, which you say is there's a fine line between trying to influence legitimate political or commercial views with undermining, gaslighting, whatever you want to kind of think about it, people's own freedom to think. What you're raising here is some very hard philosophical, political, legal problems. This whole area must be incredibly challenging. Can you give us a sense of, you know, what you face in trying to move legislation around like this?
It is really challenging. I mean, moving the legislation around, one of the really big challenges is the scale of interest in keeping the business model that's there. Even though this business model that is built on targeted advertising, particular online advertising, a particular type of online advertising, it's only really been with us for the last 10 years. It's relatively new. And yet there's been this real narrative that, you know, big tech companies are so big, they can't fail. We can't challenge them. You know, our world will fall apart if we don't have these, you know, these huge tech companies. And that certainly was the narrative over the last 5 years when I first started working on these issues. But it has been an interesting shift, probably in the last 12 months. And I mean, even this year, you know, in the first 2 months of this year, we've seen a shift with big tech layoffs. We've seen the European Data Protection Board announcing that Facebook and Instagram's business models are unlawful in Europe. We're seeing as well, even in the US, which you would have expected to be not as far ahead as Europe in this particular kind of field, starting to look at these questions and really talk about quite aggressive regulation against targeted advertising. And so I think what we're likely to see in the next year or two is that actually the house of cards is starting to fall and that there is an opportunity for setting the groundwork for the next wave of our online lives and our online world, if you like. But it was very much this business model, if you like, and business interests. And business interests that are also tied into governmental interests. You know, what Shoshana Zuboff talks about is surveillance capitalism. You know, it works very well for states who want to surveil as much as it does for the value that businesses are getting from surveilling us. And so that as well, in some places, can make it quite difficult to get radical regulation. And so what you found was that often the debates around regulation have got sidetracked into content moderation. It's not about why these systems are working. It's about how do we, you know, play whack-a-mole with content. And let's have a niche discussion about freedom of expression over here, which as well is something, you know, the freedom of expression discussion is something that's very culturally specific as well. You know, freedom of expression in the US means something very different to freedom of expression in France or Spain or Germany. The UK is possibly somewhere in between. So in a way, by talking about freedom of expression, you can enter into a bit of a sidetrack discussion around content moderation. And that's one of the reasons why I really wanted to focus back on freedom of opinion and freedom of thought. So it's not about what the content is. It's not about whether it's right wing, left wing, whatever angle you're coming from. It's about whether what's happening is manipulative. And that is about the business models, not the content. Mm-hmm. And I think it is starting to change.
How do you feel, I mean, as a parent, as an individual, your experience of being manipulated online?
It's exhausting, to be honest. I mean, you know, I've written a whole book about it and I still struggle. You know, I have to still put the Freedom app on my phone to stop me picking up and checking my emails every couple of minutes if I need a bit of peace. You know, I have a child who is, you know, in her early teens, and I see on a daily basis what the challenges are as a parent for, you know, engaging with enthusiasm about the future of technology, the future of society, but also that manipulative pattern. And I mean, even from a very young age, you'll see, you know, most parents will have experienced the absolute drama of prizing a screen out of the hands mm-hmm. of a small child, which really tells you all you need to know about mm-hmm. how these systems are working. It's not the same as trying to take a book away. You know, the TV is maybe somewhere in between, but the, you know, the phone or the iPad is a whole other story.
I read that you told your daughter that she cannot have an Alexa because it steals your dreams and sells them, which I loved.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm gonna borrow that.
She never asked again, I have to say. It was like Alexa has been out of the window.
That's awesome. I love it.
So you you referenced George Orwell's 1984 and the phenomena of face crime. Can we turn to AI? Because earlier on you mentioned about this the fact that technology is now thinking that it can infer what our inner thoughts and feelings are. How's that playing out in freedom to think?
We see it in lots of different areas. And again, as I said earlier, it's not just a private sector thing. It's also in the public sector. So, you know, you might see AI being developed to understand, you know, say, how we're feeling, help us to feel better. You know, you see AI about mindfulness and things like this, but you'd also see increasingly emotional AI wearables that, you know, are designed supposedly to point out when we're feeling miserable and help us have a better day. You see, I think it was just when I was finishing the book, I came across one story about a company somewhere in Asia that had installed cameras where you had to be looking happy to be allowed into the meeting room, which, you know, I can't think of anything more depressing than having to look happy to go into a meeting room.
I'd be locked out of everything.
Exactly. Well, yeah, and you know, question whether that makes you want to be locked out. You know, it's very, very easy, straightforward, avoid this meeting. So we do see that that's kind of the direction of a lot of AI, is extracting what we're thinking and feeling. And then from a governmental perspective, you can see it in the criminal sphere. And for example, AI being developed to infer risks, if you like, in human beings, whether it's gait analysis or facial recognition, you know, being developed to try to understand whether or not you're thinking bad thoughts and are planning to do something terrible. And whether that is, you know, in the counterterrorism sphere, or even in your local shopping mall, you know, AI being developed to see whether or not you look like someone who's about to start shoplifting. Often you'll see this kind of AI being criticized, or this kind of technology being criticized, on the basis of bias. And there's very little doubt that the way this technology is trained is often based on data that is inherently already biased. So you'll see in sort of, you know, predictive policing technology that, you know, people from minority communities are much more likely to be flagged as high risk. You'll see in technology that's designed to identify ideal candidates who'll be a great fit in a company, that, you know, if you're looking at director level, well, maybe a woman isn't going to be fitting the bill that the technology reads is what's expected of a director, and clearly what you need is a nice middle-aged white man, which will fit with what the technology's been trained to recognize as having gravitas. But aside from the bias question, in my view, this idea about freedom of thought and freedom of opinion is that if what the technology is doing or claiming to do is reading what's inside you, then that is something it shouldn't be allowed to do. And we see it, as I said, in the recruitment space, not only in technology that's parsing CVs, but also increasingly in virtual interviews where, you know, you give an interview to a camera and the recording is then taken away, filtered through AI, which will decide, based on, you know, your tone of voice, the kind of language you use, a whole set of points about the way you deliver your interview, whether you're the right kind of person, whether you're honest, whether you're diligent, all these kind of things that are being sort of extracted from you effectively talking straight to camera. And that, I think, is a concern, not just because of the discriminatory biased effect, but because what it is trying to do is make inferences about our inner lives without us explicitly revealing them.
Yeah.
So beyond what tech companies might be required to do with changing legislation, I'd love to get your thoughts on your assessment on big tech companies' approach to ethics in all of this.
That's one of the really interesting things. When I first started working on digital rights, particularly in the private sector, rather than from a pure sort of governmental security sector approach, was that suddenly talk about human rights disappeared and what we're talking about is ethics. Now, ethics are great. I mean, obviously, you know, operating in an ethical fashion is to be desired, should be good for everyone. But you can't take ethics to court. You can't enforce ethics. And so the way we've seen the discourse developing around technology as being technology and ethics, AI and ethics, instead of AI and human rights or technology and human rights, sort of separates it. It puts it into a space where effectively the law seems not to apply. And we've seen the ethics arguments being used as well alongside an argument that, you know, technology is operating in a regulation-free zone, that it's all so new that the regulation can't keep up. But actually, if you go back to basics and you apply things like the right to freedom of thought or the right to private life and look at how they would apply, what they mean in the technological space, we do have these laws. We have human rights and human rights laws at the international and national levels. And for me, human rights are ethics with teeth. And so I have this kind of sense that actually talking about ethics and reassuring everyone that, you know, we're thinking about ethics and creating new ethical frameworks is a way of effectively avoiding accountability and the really hard questions and the potential that what you're doing will be deemed to be unlawful and you're going to have to stop.
Mm. Well, that's interesting because, you know, Facebook's attempts to establish an ethics committee didn't prove to have very much teeth or any effectiveness on influencing the direction of the company. How do you think organizations are going to be, how are you and people in your sphere going to give the application of human rights in the tech space more teeth, do you think?
Well, I think, as you say, self-regulation just doesn't really have legs when it comes to serious accountability. There is amazing work being done by civil society organizations and advocates for digital rights around the world. You know, there's an incredible organization based in the UK called Foxglove, who've been bringing really interesting cases against tech companies like Facebook in Kenya, as well as other places around the world. In Europe, we're seeing increasing challenges again, like Max Schrems, the Austrian privacy advocate who challenged Facebook's ability to share data across the Atlantic. And we're seeing now in the US with Gonzalez and Google at the Supreme Court how tech companies are beginning to be held to account and questioned and having to explain themselves in legal terms in front of courts as to the human rights impacts of their technology and their business practices. And so I really do think that it is in those spaces, in court, that we are seeing a much faster development than one might have even expected 5 years ago, which is then being reflected in the regulators and lawmakers playing catch up. But it is also showing that actually the laws are there. One of the big challenges for enforcing the law is the cost of bringing a legal case. You know, it's prohibitive for most people. And for civil society organizations in many countries, it is as well. But then you see, you know, that is where there's a real need for independent institutions that can bring human rights cases, for example, on behalf of the people. So in Spain, for example, when Spain brought in a law which allowed political parties to use people's data for the purposes of targeted political advertising and profiling, it wasn't an individual. It was the Spanish ombudsman, the Defensor del Pueblo, who brought a case to the Spanish Constitutional Court arguing that this law brought in by the government was unconstitutional on human rights grounds, including the right to freedom of thought as well as the right to privacy. And they won that case, and the law was then effectively annulled. So having independent institutions that can bring these questions is really vital. But unfortunately, the current climate around human rights in many countries means that those institutions that actually have teeth and the kind of funding that you need to bring these cases are few and far between. And so we are seeing a lot of those cases are being brought and backed by civil society organizations globally. But it's happening, and it's happening despite those huge hurdles.
Did you know? You can find us on Twitter at @evolving_leader. We're also on LinkedIn and Instagram at @evolvingleader. If you're on any of these social media platforms, we invite you to follow along and comment on your favourite episodes. Now, back to the conversation.
So speaking of different governments, what are your thoughts on the activities by the Chinese and Russian governments and how they're wielding influence over their populations?
I think it's very difficult to know exactly what is happening in Russia and China, to be honest. One of the things that I wrote about in the book was the social credit system that's been talked about a lot in relation to China. And there have been reports that would indicate that people who have been deemed based on their data, including things like social media activity, but also their connections, etc., to be bad citizens are then being barred from, for example, access to public transport and that sort of thing. But actually, you know, those sorts of developments we're seeing in many ways in our own countries, in our own democracies, but under another guise. So, you know, what we see, for example, in the UK, and I'm sure it's the case in the US and other countries, is that massive data brokers are coming together and using huge troves of our personal data to decide whether or not we are people who are worthy of credit, for example, whether you're worthy of getting a mortgage, whether you're worthy of getting insurance. And so we're seeing it in the private sector, but it is essentially the same thing. It's the same thing as social credit, but used for access to private sector services. What you do see with China and Russia, I think, which is very interesting, certainly the way it's been reported, is the use of technology globally to affect what's happening in politics in other countries. I mean, they're clearly not alone. And I think that's one of the really big challenges when you start looking at hostile state actors using the online space to affect democratic elections, for example, is that it's very difficult to know which state actors have completely clean hands when it comes to, you know, taking action, influence operations globally. So I think we have to be very careful. And I think that sometimes, you know, while there are really dystopian and extremely serious examples of abuse of technology for the control and manipulation of populations in both Russia and China, I think we need to be very cautious about people also to say, well, you know, whatever we're doing here, it's not as bad as what they're doing over there. So it's all fine. I think you have to be very careful not to kind of single out Russia and China and say, well, if we're not Russia and China, then we're okay. And often you can see that as part of the narrative. So yes, hugely problematic, but a lot of the same kind of situations or use cases that you see in China and Russia are not far from being used in our own countries. And the really big question, the really important point, which is under threat, I think, around the world, is how do you ensure accountability? How do you ensure respect for human rights when states violate them? That is a big problem in China and in Russia, is how can you be a dissident? How can you challenge the state? And we need to really make sure that in our own countries, it is still possible to challenge the state. It is still possible to raise human rights questions and push back. Because if we lose that, we will really have lost all our protection.
And it seems like it's a tricky balancing act to introduce legislation that achieves those goals and engage the public and commercial sectors in it. I mean, if you take GDPR, Digital Services Act, that the EU pioneered, the public and business probably don't see the value of those things. They see them as bureaucratic red tape a lot of the time. How do you think we could do a better job in capturing the public's imagination in these things?
Well, in many ways, that's what I hope to do with my book, to be honest. And it was, you know, for me, it came out of a bit of a light bulb moment when I first read about Cambridge Analytica. And I was reading people talking about privacy and data protection. And you know, I have to admit that while I'd worked on privacy and data protection for years and written plenty of policy briefings about them and recognized how important they were they also slightly sent me to sleep. You know, I didn't relish the idea of, you know, writing a piece about GDPR in any way, shape or form. However, when I read about Cambridge Analytica, I thought this goes beyond the data. This is not about data. This is about freedom of thought. And that disturbed me so much that it sort of pushed me into a bit of a one-woman mission to kind of raise this idea and this discussion. Because I thought, if this has upset me so much, maybe this will make other people realize why this stuff matters. And that's why I wanted to write a book that was accessible, that was personal, that was not simply a kind of list of what I think the regulations ought to be out there. So I think it is about understanding how it affects you personally, what the risks might be, and understanding that we all have human rights. I think we've allowed ourselves to be lulled into a false sense of security, to feel like only bad people need human rights. But cases like Cambridge Analytica, I think, really demonstrate that actually, you know, if your next door neighbor's mind is hijacked, then that is potentially a problem for you, even if you have not been directly affected by Cambridge Analytica. It's about understanding that these particular issues, where privacy and data protection are a gateway right, if you like, they're gateway rights to our minds, to our neighbors' minds, to our community's minds, that hopefully will allow people to understand how important they are. I think there has also been quite a lot of propaganda against GDPR. You know, people have been encouraged to think it's just red tape. You see ridiculous examples of implementation of GDPR, where you'll be told, I remember in some parent group in primary school, we're suddenly told we couldn't have an email group amongst parents because of GDPR. And I mean, you know, you just want to bash your head in the wall reading that kind of thing. And then they decided we could have a WhatsApp group. And I was sort of like, oh my God, what on earth is going on? But, you know, it was also, okay, whatever, I can mute the WhatsApp group. But you see a lot of this, you know, that people are saying, oh, we can't do this, we can't do that because of GDPR. Meanwhile, the most sort of egregious violations are going on a daily basis, and people are saying there's no regulation. So I think understanding why these things are important, and also understanding that they don't prevent you having a voluntary email group, if, you know, if that's what you want to do, is a really important part of getting those messages across.
What are the implications here for leaders and organizations as they increasingly become dependent on digital and social technologies to prosper?
I think there are several things. I mean, one of the things that I think is really important about our freedom of thought and freedom of opinion is that that is what allows us to innovate. That if we lose our capacity for freedom of thought and freedom of opinion, we lose our capacity to innovate. And so there is a risk that if technology is going down this track of trying to extract information from us in order to control our minds, then we will not effectively get any further than where we are already. And it's something, you know, in 1984, George Orwell talks about how, you know, scientists in this world that he created are reduced to emotional manipulation and warmongering. Those are kind of your options if you want to be a scientist in George Orwell's world. And so if we want a future of innovation, if leaders really want to take a step into the future, then they need to protect that. They need to think about what technology they're using. Is it dampening their employees' ability to innovate? Is it dampening their own ability to innovate? Is it going to stifle their community's ability to innovate? What does it mean for the world that their children will live in? And it's one of the things that I find really interesting, looking at the, you know, the current wave of AI that sort of captured the public imagination, particularly things like ChatGPT. It's a kind of, why are we looking at developing AI that can mimic what we can already do as humans, and that we actually enjoy doing, some of us, you know, that we like writing, we like speaking, you know, humans enjoy this. Why are we actually developing AI to kill human creativity? Why are we not developing AI to do things that humans can't do? You know, surely that is the direction we should be looking at for our future. And so I think really thinking, is what I'm developing, is what I'm doing, is it going to improve our human future? Is it going to do something that we've never been able to do before? Or is it effectively going to crush our humanity? And I think those are really important philosophical questions to ask yourself.
Yeah, I agree.
Susie, what kind of reaction have you had across the political spectrum to your ideas?
Surprisingly, I think one of the things that I was almost happiest about at the end of last year was seeing the book as one of the books of the year on technology and new science in both the Financial Times and the Telegraph. And, you know, the Telegraph in the UK is a sort of centre-right, if you like, broadsheet newspaper. And so understanding that it was being recognised as a book of the year in the Telegraph, as opposed to, you know, something like The Guardian, which is more traditionally left-wing, human rights friendly, made me hope that this idea of freedom of thought is something that is not partisan, that actually, you know, it's something that resonates to all of us, because it's not about what your political opinion is. It's very much about, you know, what it means to be human, what you hope for your future, for your children's future. And so I've been positively surprised, really, because it's one of those things, again, when you go back to the discussions about freedom of expression in particular, you land up with arguments about what expression should be allowed, and it then kind of divides into a sort of culture war dynamic. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're talking about not wanting to be manipulated, well, there aren't that many people who really want to be manipulated if they think about it in those terms. I mean, you know, people might want to be influenced. People might want to get some guidance on things. But most people don't really like the idea that they're being manipulated, regardless of their political opinions. I think the fact that it's about freedom as well is also helpful. You know, the idea of privacy feels much more closed in, and some people are sort of like, well, you know, what does it matter? I've got nothing to hide. But when you're talking about the freedom to think for yourself, I think that resonates very differently, and I think it resonates across the board.
You talk about how nobody wants to be manipulated, and it gets me thinking how nobody thinks they are manipulated. How do people get more honest and take more inventory of the ways in which perhaps they are being manipulated?
I absolutely agree with you. It's one of the things that you saw very much in the sort of in the discussions around Cambridge Analytica, was some people going, well, you know, of course only idiots are going to be manipulated by this sort of thing. And you're like, well, that's obviously, that makes you a prime target. If you think you're too clever for manipulation, then, you know, then we know how to get to you. And so I think one of the things is to look at the kind of data that's being held on you and think about how it's being reflected back at you. Look at what Amazon is suggesting for you. An interesting experiment actually I found recently was looking up my book on Amazon, and several sort of friends and other people that I work with, I asked them to look up, and what then comes up as the promoted adverts very much depends on, you know, who's in their household, where they live, who they are, and can kind of range from, you know, self-help psychotherapy books through scientific books, through probably the worst one I saw was quotes from Andrew Tate, which was just horrific that would be the promoted material that would pop up on Amazon. And so understanding, you know, from looking at what's in your feed, taking time out and asking yourself why you're getting the adverts that you're getting, I think helps. Although, again, people then look, and when they start to look, say, well, of course, I wasn't drawn in by that. I haven't gone and bought stuff. Look at how much stuff you've bought that you really didn't need. You know, look around your house and see how much junk you've bought online. Look at the amount of time you spend on your phone. That's a really interesting one, is that when you use tools to check how often you pick up your phone, you know, when you actually look at that, and like I say, you know, I've written a whole book about it. I still struggle with it myself. You sit there going, God, how much time have I lost? And why is that happening? It's not accidental. It's about manipulation. And there are tools as well that you can use online to look at things like your Twitter feed and see a readout of how what your Twitter feed is saying about you. I mean, I have to say that when I did that, it came back that I was a 30-something man, which I thought was interesting because I mostly use Twitter for professional purposes. So I, you know, apart from a bit of feminist art, I clearly wasn't, you know, bringing my whole self to Twitter. But I think if you start looking at how the internet perceives you, and remember that it doesn't even matter if it gets you wrong, because it might get you wrong, that still might land you up being stopped by the police because it got you wrong. So it's important to bear in mind that it doesn't matter if it's rubbish. It's still being used. It might still be used to penalize you. It might still be used to prevent you getting a mortgage. Or it might be used to manipulate you successfully.
So thinking about, you know, the freedom to think for younger people, as we're kind of talking about ourselves here, I think to a large extent, you're sitting in front of an audience of 16 to 24-year-olds and helping them to navigate this world. What advice might you give them?
I suppose to use a primary school analogy. When my daughter was at primary school, you knew you were in trouble when you were told to think about it on the starboard. So I'd say that. But actually, I mean, I have spoken to sixth formers in school, and their questions are exactly the same. In many ways, they're more savvy. And I remember coming home one day when I was feeling very tired on the train, and I accidentally clicked on a link in some WhatsApp message that had come through to me. And my daughter, when I got home, she said, "Oh, Mum, you're worse than Bob the Alien, who is the person that they they get to teach them about tech safety at school." So I think with younger people, it's, you know, they are aware of these issues very much. And it's about talking to them about activism, I suppose, and pushing back and explaining to them that they do have the power to change things, that this is not a given, that they can decide whether that's through choosing what to use and what not to use, whether it's in designing the next big thing in social media, or whether it's in joining a digital rights movement and demanding their rights. I think it's about agency and telling them, you know, they're the future. It's up to them to be thinking about the future they want and that they can do things to bring it about. But actually, on tech use, they probably know more than we do.
Yeah.
What's the next set of challenges for you? What are you working on at the moment?
One of the big things that I'm looking at the moment is what the sort of the big challenges we're facing today, particularly the impact of tech cross-border, but also the really, really fundamental existential challenge that we're facing of climate change, what those mean for the future of human governance, what they mean for how we're going to use human rights and enjoy human rights in the future. So taking this, I suppose, going from the very internal aspects of freedom of thought to looking at the global aspects of what happens when our borders become in some ways meaningless in terms of our ability to protect ourselves and design our future.
Susie, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. And more importantly, thank you for the work that you're doing in the world.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. And thanks so much for your work too.
And for our listeners, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?